Time to Ask, a new initiative to improve screening for unhealthy alcohol use in Maine. The opiate crisis gets much of the public health community's attention in Maine these days, but problem drinking hasn't gone away. Researchers say it's a major contributor to chronic health problems, hospitalizations, and accidents, and continues to have long-lasting effects on the lives of Mainers. And yet, despite all of this, some researchers believe that doctors and other first-line providers don't do enough to screen for possible alcohol misuse. In fact, there's a case being made that providers don't get the kind of training they need to be able to ask the right questions of their patients. I'm Keith Shortall, and today we'll take a closer look at the alcohol problem and at a new initiative aimed at helping physicians and other healthcare providers engage in honest conversations with their patients about their drinking. Maine Calling examines the Time to Ask initiative. First, this news. Keith Shortall, and this is Maine Calling. The abuse of opioids may dominate the headlines, but alcohol remains the most commonly consumed substance in Maine that requires the most treatment. Today we're going to learn about an effort to help healthcare providers identify, assess, and recommend treatment for patients who may be consuming an unhealthy amount of alcohol. With me in the studio is Mary Lindsay Smith, a research associate at the Cutler Institute of Health and Social Policy, which is part of the University of Southern Maine's Muskie School of Public Service. Joining us from our Bangor studio, Noah Nesson. He's Vice President of Medical Affairs at the Penobscot Community Health Center and has been a board-certified family physician in Maine for 30-plus years. And joining us from Monitor Studios in Washington, D.C. is Sean Yardley. He's a founding member of the Bangor Area Recovery Network and past director of the City of Bangor's Health and Community Services. Thanks to all of you for joining us today. As always, we want to hear from you as well. What would you know how to tell if someone had a problem with alcohol? Our phone number is 800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mpbn.net, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. Sean, I thought we'd start with you. We're going to be talking about medical policy, about public health policy, about alcohol and its effects on the community. But we also wanted to, if we could, start with a personal story. And your story may help us inform put a human face on some of the issues that we're talking about today. Can you tell us about your journey through this?
Sure. So I grew up in a family that was impacted by alcoholism. My father was an active alcoholic much of my growing up years. My grandfather died of the disease. And so as I became a young adult, I was committed not to fall into the same pattern as those before me. And I went on, got a degree, went to work as a child protective worker, and found myself with some health issues that I thought were related to my job. So I had lots of testing done. And at the end of all the testing that was done, my doctor sort of said, "The only thing I can find, Sean, is that your kidneys are working a little more than they should be. How much do you drink?" And in the moment, I minimized, and he backed away from that kind of questioning, never to ask me again. And it really was the beginning for me of sort of having to look hard and fast in the mirror that maybe I was actually moving in the direction that I had, you know, vowed not to, and that was toward, you know, problem drinking. And I think I began in that moment to sort of face the reality that I probably had a problem and that I was indeed an alcoholic. And I didn't immediately turn away, but it was one of those things that just nagged at me, and it really got me to a place where for the last 29 years I've been free of alcohol and all kinds of drugs.
So was it that question in that meeting with your physician that sort of got you to thinking, got the wheels turning?
Yeah, I think it, because it was a really sort of a concrete, because I had worked really hard to control my drinking. You know, I limited how much I drank. I limited the days a week that I drank, and you know what time of day I would start to have a beverage. I was very successful in my career, so by all outward measures, I was doing okay. But when I saw through the doctor's test that actually my body was having a reaction to what I was drinking, I really had to look at that, and it really started me to move. And it's funny, as I was talking about coming on this radio show, I told that story to my wife thinking that she had known I had shared that before, and I'd never shared that particular piece of that was really pretty significant in my life. I've been real open about my recovery in lots of ways, certainly with my wife, but I'd never recounted that story. I didn't come home from the doctor and say, gee, guess what? He thinks my kidneys are, you know, having a problem because I'm drinking too much. I, you know, certainly didn't want to at that time sort of expose myself, make myself vulnerable to that possibility, because I'd spent my life denying it and working so that I didn't look like my father or my grandfather. And so it was really, you know, sort of a red letter day. And I remember where it was, the office I was in, how it all played out, because it was that significant. But I kept it to myself for all that time.
Dr. Noah Nesson, how does that story fit in, I guess, again, in the common, the present context of how you think physicians are talking with their patients about the possibility of how drinking might be affecting their health? Is it happening enough? Is it not happening enough? Where are we?
Well, we don't think it's happening enough, or more correctly, effectively enough. So the question that Sean was asked, I would say, is very typical. How much do you drink? And we know that it's very likely that people will understate the amount of alcohol that they use when they're asked in that way. Even at that, when we record it, we tend to record it in the social history and not in the problem list if we're concerned about the amount of alcohol a person may be drinking. And even in circumstances where we have reason to suspect that they may be drinking more than they're reporting, we tend not to confront people about that. We're uncomfortable with it because of the stigma of misuse or abuse or addiction to a substance, and because of time constraints. And so we're not very effective at asking those questions or at following up when we get answers that should raise concern for us. I think what's unusual about Sean's instance was that it had an impact on him without going any further than that. But there are strategies to make sure that we do go further to try and impact more people who may have at-risk use of alcohol so that they can modify their behaviors in the way that Sean did before they develop addiction or long-term health consequences from alcohol use.
So is it that physicians are intimidated about talking about this, or because they seem to be willing to talk about all kinds of uncomfortable things with their patients? What's at the core of why maybe they're not going deeply enough into this line of questioning?
Well, most of us who trained, you know, more than just a few years ago when we were in medical school and in our training residencies were taught to ask about alcohol, but the way we asked was, how much do you drink and how often? And we would record that, as I said, in the social history. There are more effective ways to ask that question. There are validated screening tools to look for people who have at-risk use of alcohol, and it may be that we know that there are 17 million people in the United States, 7% of our adult population, who actually meet the criteria for alcoholism or alcohol use disorder. There's another 60 million who may be at risk use of alcohol, maybe using alcohol in a way that puts them at risk for either addiction or health problems. And if we can identify them, have a brief conversation with them about what might motivate them to change their use of alcohol, there's perhaps a third or more of them that would respond to that simple intervention. And so instead of asking how much do you drink and how often, there are some very specific questions we can ask. There's a single question screening that consists of how many times in the past year have you had five drinks in one evening, for men, four drinks for women. And if they say never, the screening's over. If they say, you know, once or more, then there are additional questions that can ask, but it's not time consuming. There are tools that we have available to us to do this kind of work, but we have not been trained in doing the work. We're increasingly under time constraints. And I would say that the population of physicians and other clinicians, healthcare providers, nurse practitioners, and PAs doing primary care have the same reticence about raising these challenging subjects as the population at large. So if you think about people talking to their friends or family members when they may have a concern, it's a little bit of a hurdle to get over that, to say, you know, I have a concern about what I'm hearing from you about your use of alcohol, and I'd like to explore that further.
All right, we'll talk more about the screening and some specifics about how this might work. Lindsay, so we just heard a few statistics about the significance of the problem in the United States, the number of alcoholics. Introduce us to Maine here. What's the profile of Maine as you see it statistically with respect to either alcoholism or misuse of alcohol?
So as you said in your introduction, that alcohol is the most misused substance in the state of Maine. And in fact, we are above the national medians on regular alcohol consumption, heavy drinking and binge drinking, and our need for treatment in this area. So what Noah's pointing out is huge, that we really need to address this across the spectrum, where we're dealing with a variety of levels of at-risk drinking. Binge drinking is increasingly been highlighted by the CDC as a problem. And so in the past, it has always been this dichotomous discussion around alcohol use, but really the research is showing that this is a spectrum and that we really need to address this, and preventative efforts can increasingly help us address this early on in individuals before their alcohol use might exacerbate or bring on new health conditions.
In terms of public policy, as we know, Maine is, you know, considered to be tough, for example, on drunk driving. One way to protect society from the consequences of overdrinking. But what are the other realms of public policy that could be through which we might address this issue?
Well, I think one of the biggest issues we're facing now is really trying to address this in a primary care setting. We do not have the treatment infrastructure in the state that you brought up earlier, the opiate addiction. We really are stretched in our ability to care for people dealing with substance misuse. And so not only do we need to build our infrastructure around treatment and the provision of behavioral health services, but we need to think of new ways to provide care to people. And primary care providers are uniquely situated to do that because of the frequency in which they see patients. They often develop long-lasting relationships and have a level of trust with their patients to be able to assess this on an ongoing basis. So it's thinking outside of the box and continuing to break down those silos. Substance use is not its own category. It's a chronic disease. We need to treat it as a chronic disease, and therefore it needs to be treated in medical settings.
Yeah, Dr. Nussen, so talk a little bit more, if you would, about the specifics of how we get at this screening beyond the how much do you drink or how many drinks do you have in a week, that sort of thing. You touched on this earlier, but what specifically are you hoping to get physicians and other frontline folks to do a better job at screening for misuse?
Well, this is the big broader question in primary care, which is, I think, where we have the most opportunity to do some good preventive work around risky use of alcohol. And it's really a matter of trying to institute universal screening for substance use disorder in primary care, and in this instance, specifically for alcohol use disorder or at-risk use of alcohol. So using the tools that we know help us identify more efficiently and effectively the people who either have alcohol use disorder or are using alcohol in ways that puts their health at risk, and being able to respond to that in a meaningful way. So it doesn't help to screen for issues if we're not ready to deal with them, but the manner in which we deal with them is not a high skill level set. It's really an ability to talk a little bit more with people, find out what their motivation might be to change at this point, and their ability to change and to start the conversation with them, and then to document it in such a way, if it is a problem, that it becomes one of the chronic health problems that we address in our follow-up visits with people. Part of the approach in primary care then means that this really needs to be a team effort. This can't all be put on the shoulders of the physician or nurse practitioner or PA. These kind of questions can be done as part of an entry process in a form or on a tablet, or we even have in our organization a pilot in which we're sending people in a secure way surveys like this that they do on their smartphone and then send back, and it automatically populates into the electronic health record. So there will be a number of ways to skin this cat. But the first hurdle is to create the momentum, the support for the idea that this is an important part of what we should be doing in primary care.
So I'm sure this happens now or prior to this initiative, where a patient goes in and, you know, their liver enzymes are up. There's some red flag that points to an alcohol problem. The physician says, look, your liver enzymes are up. You've got to do something about this or stop, or you could, you know, be in serious health problem developing if it hasn't already. So that's sort of one medical approach to it. How do you then, though, go at someone who how do you get at someone who might be starting to drink a little too much, and maybe there's, you know, blood pressure is up, or in those areas where there's less of a direct link, how do you have that conversation?
Right, and even without any health effects yet, if we're doing universal screening, we'll identify people who have no health effects yet from their alcohol use, but we identify they're at risk in their use. So we use one of these tools. We see somebody who scores above the threshold where we're concerned about their use of alcohol, and the technique is called motivational interviewing, which is simply to explore in a non-judgmental fashion their use of alcohol, the times when they use it, what drives them to use it, and educate people about the risks of that they're undertaking when they use alcohol. So not only the health risks that people are aware of, liver impacts, you know, some people are aware that it can impact your brain in the long term, but also that alcohol is a class one carcinogen. Most people are aware of the sort of, you know, when you use alcohol to intoxication, the impaired judgment and the problems that can ensue from that. So just having in a non-judgmental way an open conversation with people about their perspectives on their own use of alcohol, providing them some education, assessing the factors that might motivate them to change their use of alcohol, and then asking them to contemplate that, or if they're ready for change, to start to make changes in some incremental fashion if abstinence is not a necessary part of their approach. Many of these people with at-risk use of alcohol simply need to reduce the amount of alcohol that they're drinking in order to get back into a less risky category.
All right, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, your comments and questions. The number is 800-399-3566. That's 1-800-399-3566. This is Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
Broadcast of Maine Calling is made possible by MPBN listener contributions and by Lee Honda in Auburn, featuring the 2016 Honda HR-V crossover. Inventory and pricing at leeauto.com.
On the next Fresh Air, comics Nadia Manzoor, who grew up in England in a conservative Muslim Pakistani family, and Radhika Vaz, who grew up in India, they have a web sketch comedy series called Shugs and Fats, in which they play immigrant Muslim women dressed in burqas, trying to adapt to their new culture of their home in Brooklyn. In their real lives, Manzoor and Vaz are feminists. Join us.
That's ahead tonight on Fresh Air at 7 o'clock.
Hello, I'm Linda Hunt. Next time on City Arts and Lectures, we'll hear from Dr. Ayanna Howard, a leading authority on robotics. She'll discuss current applications of artificial intelligence and the future of robotics with Dr. Indre Viscontis. That's next time on City Arts and Lectures on this public radio station.
Join us for City Arts and Lectures tomorrow afternoon at 1 o'clock.
And welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Keith Shortall. Today on the program, warning signs and how to help someone who may have a problem with how much alcohol they're consuming. With me in our studio, Mary Lindsay Smith. She's a research associate at USM's Cutler Institute of Health and Social Policy. Joining us from our Bangor studio, Noah Nessen. He's vice president of medical affairs at the Penobscot Community Health Center and has been a board-certified family physician in Maine for 30-plus years. Joining us from Washington, D.C., Sean Yardley. He's a founding member of Bangor Area Recovery Network and past director of the City of Bangor's Health and Community Services. We invite you to join the conversation. The number is 800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mpbn.net, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. Sean Yardley, you said at the top of the show when you were telling us your personal story that you were asked by a physician about your own drinking, and that triggered some introspection and some change on your part. Obviously it's important that patients be honest with themselves and with their physician at the time that these conversations take place. How much of a problem is that, getting the patient to even acknowledge that they drink too much?
Well, I mean, I think that's really the challenge. And, you know, I think people have to be ready, and what makes them ready is varied. But one of the things that, for me, that has been really important, whenever I have a new provider, to Dr. Nessen's point, I say to them, you know, you need to know if you're going to treat me that I'm a person in recovery, and this is what it means for me. And so when they're contemplating, you know, I've had some surgeries where I've had to have, you know, narcotics, that I have a really, really honest conversation, because for me, while my primary issue was the misuse of alcohol, I think, you know, underlying that is I have, you know, sort of an addictive personality. And so I have to be very, very careful and honest with myself, with my family, and with my providers. And one of the things that really has caused me a great deal of concern, which is why I'm, you know, willing to do these kinds of things, is I think the issue and the risks of alcohol has sort of taken a back seat to the attention that, rightly so, that we're placing on opiates. And I have a lot of, you know, I've had teenagers in my house since 96. And so I've heard over time parents say, well, I'm glad my child's only drinking and not, you know, back then it was doing marijuana, and now it's obviously lots of other things. And that concerns me, because I think while we need to attend to the opiate addiction, we really need to spend lots of time and attention on this issue as well.
Yeah, let's go to the phones here with a question on screening for kids. We'll go to Steve in Dover, Foxcroft. Hi, Steve.
Hey, yeah. And, yeah, so Sean said it where I was going to ask, which, you know, I don't want to get into my abuse, but substance abuse, but still, our pediatrician was asking elementary kids, are they screening elementary kids and, you know, middle school kids, you know, that, you know, are you using alcohol, you know, are you, you know, and if you are, what are your experience? I just think that Sean really touched upon that, you know, addictive behavior, that impulsive behavior, and, you know, a lot of things that I grew up with, you know, friends thought that that kind of drinking was okay, and that was how you know, became an adult. You did those kind of things, not realizing the things that were happening maybe are warning signs. And but people see their pediatricians, you know, most, you know, some people do, or they get screened by their school counselor. So my question is, are pediatricians and school counselors asking that question, direct question, are you using alcohol, I guess? So.
Yeah. Dr. Nessen?
Well, that's been part of the routine screening starting around puberty in pediatrics for quite a long time. Now, how effectively that is asked, and if it's asked in a situation where the child has an opportunity to answer honestly, is probably less consistent. But it's important, because one in four high school students in Maine reports drinking alcohol in the prior month. One in six admits to binge drinking among people age 18 to 25. 4 out of 10 admit to binge drinking in the prior month. So it's a big issue, and I think any of us growing up could identify among our friends those who started drinking at a fairly early age, 10 or 12, and that significantly increases the risk of alcohol use disorder as an adult.
Yeah. So do we have a we don't have a pediatrician here on the panel today. Maybe if one is listening, you can call in and let us know about where screening is at that level, or any. Yeah, go ahead,
Keith. I could also add that this is a focus of the National Institute on Drug Abuse, and there's a Northeast Clinical Trial Network based at Dartmouth, and a lot of their efforts are aimed at adolescent substance use disorder or abuse of substances. So this is an area of focus, I know, and pediatricians, if there's one listening, I'm sure they could add a lot to it. I know for family doctors, we use the same kind of approaches for caring for children, and it is a routine part of that screening. I'm comfortable saying that it's probably done with varying degrees of effectiveness, depending on an individual practitioner or a practice's commitment to asking these really important questions.
The number is 800-399-3566. That's 1-800-399-3566. You mentioned earlier that the approach toward the sort of this new approach or screening and the questioning is sort of I guess not meant to be accusatory. It moves away from the finger wagging that some physicians in the past might have done. You know, you better stop this, or there's not much I can do for you, and more of sort of educating them and being non-judgmental, but just sort of explaining to them what the health effects are. Is that the idea?
That's right, and assessing their own level of concern about their use of alcohol. Asking questions like, have other people expressed concern about your use of alcohol? Those are conversation starters. And even if you don't get the headway that you'd like to get at that first visit, it sends this powerful message that I'm open to discussing this in a non-judgmental way, so that if you have concerns, as with any health concerns, I'm your resource. I'm willing to engage on that and help you with that. That's been found to be more effective than our sort of traditional approach. And the questions that we ask on these, using these tools, are asked in much more neutral ways. So, you know, I gave the single question screen that we asked, but the full screen, which is called AUDIT, AUDIT, is a 10 question, and it really asks questions like that: how often during the last year have you found that you're not able to stop drinking once you started? How often have you needed a first drink in the morning to get yourself going after? Some heavy drinking in the evening before. So, you know, it works through in severity of questions, and you simply score that. And that's a great way to start a conversation. And look, your score on this is higher than we like to see. It means that you may be using alcohol in a way that puts your health at risk. Can we talk about that some? And it's very unusual for people to say, no, absolutely not, I don't want to talk about that. But it is much more common for us to ask questions in ways that don't actively communicate that we consider this as a health problem like any other health problem and want to discuss it in important ways.
So what do you do if the answer from the patient is, I don't want to talk about that, or that's none of your business, or I don't drink too much and that's fine, but you suspect that a health problem is being caused by alcohol? How do you treat that? Is it in the same way that you might treat a diabetic that you know is not watching their diet? You treat the condition based upon what's needed, right, and not just tell them, hey, stop doing this.
That's right. And the response, and that is sometimes a response. If a person isn't in the stage of their introspection about this where they see it as a problem, then simply educating them, saying, I only ask out of concern as your healthcare provider, as your doctor, and I want you to know that I'm open to talking about this in the future. And because I'm concerned, I will ask you about this in the future, but I'm not judging you. If you feel that you're managing this okay at this point, We'll leave it at that. I'm not going to, you know, you don't force people to do things that they're unwilling to do, especially around a topic like this, but continuing to engage in the discussion in a respectful way, just as you would for any other disease. And speaking about alcohol use disorder, if you suspect that's the issue, as a disease, helps to frame that in a way that we're more likely to be comfortable continuing to bring it up. So it's not in the context of a stigma or an accusation, but as you just said, if I have a diabetic patient or a patient with chronic lung disease, because they don't want to talk about their diabetes doesn't mean that I would just give up on it. I would continue to try and work with them, identify the barriers to them being willing to communicate about it, address those barriers, in a respectful and often necessarily patient way, and get to a point where we can start to have that discussion. And just because it doesn't work at the first visit doesn't mean that it won't work at the second or third or fourth time that you have that conversation.
All right, let's go to Mary in Wells. Hi, Mary.
Oh, hi. Let me just pull over.
Yes.
So I just wanted to share that in an earlier life, I had a friend who, it became apparent that she had a drinking problem, and she was the mother of several children. And what I observed one day in going to visit her is I could hear her, it was the summertime, so the doors were open. Anyway, so she screamed at her son, who was only 6 years old, to go get her a beer because she was on the sofa. And I watched her son go into the kitchen, get a bottle of beer out of the refrigerator, open it, and drink almost half of it. Because when I got to the door, I saw him, which he then saw me, realizing that, oh my God, somebody saw me drinking the beer. And then he went into his mother and gave her the beer, which was really shocking to me and concerned me. And I just wanted to share that.
Yeah. As shocking as that sounds, I'm sure this happens every day. There's an earlier caller also couldn't stay on the line, but was asking a question about the culture of drinking in Maine.
Right.
That this is, you know, unlike the sort of the stigma attached to being a heroin user. Drinking is just part of everyday life. It seems it's advertised.
Yeah.
It's part of kicking back and having a good time as part of our, I guess, the way that we view our culture. So this is a much heavier issue, Lindsay, I'm guessing, to combat.
Yes, I mean it's woven into the fabric of our society, and so it's become a very acceptable part of life. And in fact, sometimes people don't understand when individuals choose not to drink. That's not the norm.
A stigma. Like, you have to explain yourself.
And it's an additional stigma. And so what Noah's really talking to is the importance of, you know, bringing this into light as an ongoing regular discussions about health. The more we talk about this, not just in medical settings, but as a society and how we want to deal with drinking in our culture, how we want to address people who are having problems with alcohol as a larger community is very important. It's not just for the medical community. It's for us as a culture to work with each other to help facilitate healthy alcohol use and make sure that people that are struggling with alcohol use are able to access the resources that they need to deal with their chronic disease. It's a chronic disease.
Yeah, Sean, how do we find the line between, sort of reasonable, healthy alcohol use and something that's potentially problematic? Is it different for different people? Is it defined by how your life is going, how your kidneys are doing? Where does that line exist?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, I think, you know, there's a joke in the recovery community, sort of like, if I could drink safely, I'd drink every day. And there's some truth to that. If I thought I could drink safely, but I always felt like I had to watch to make sure. And so as my children have grown to the age where they are making their own choices now as adults, sort of the questions I ask them are really, they are the ones that have to answer that question. I strongly believe there's a genetic component. So my children have, you know, there's odds are that one of them or more of them may have the genetic predisposition. And for me, they have to find their way, and I can be an example. And I grew up seeing the worst of it, and my children, thank goodness, have never seen me drink. And so they haven't even seen up close and personal, I mean, I'm sure they have through friends, the ravages of the disease, and I did and still chose to take the path I took. So I just have really candid conversations with my children, and I ask them questions, and most of the time they're pretty respectful about that. But there are times when, you know, maybe I push a little hard and say, gee, I'd like to have you look at that. And I think it's about normalizing the conversation in the same way that I might, you know, gee, you look like you've gained some weight, you know, are you making healthy choices, you know? And I think that's the challenge that we have. We need to normalize having those conversations as much as we normalize, here, you deserve a beer tonight because you've worked hard today.
Yeah. It's amazing you can see me through the radio radio equipment there. I have gained a little weight. Sorry.
I also want to say that I think it's important to note that there are recommended guidelines around drinking, but there technically is no safe level of drinking. Alcohol use affects every organ in your body, and everybody reacts differently. So it's important to note that what the recommended guidelines might adhere for one person might be different for another, and they vary by gender and age and specific conditions. If you are taking medications or you're suffering from diabetes, those recommended guidelines might be lower. But I just want to make that clear that it's a construct that's hard to nail down exactly what is safe.
Yeah, go ahead. Dr. Nessen.
Yeah, yeah. Just to add on to that, for instance, regular use of alcohol at any level by a woman increases her risk of breast cancer, and the more alcohol she uses, the more the risk is increased. So I want to endorse what Lindsay just said. It's true. We can't know the health effects of alcohol on any individual because there is a genetic predisposition not only to addiction but to the adverse effects of alcohol in their system. Having said that, we do have standards that we recommend people follow to stay as safe as they can be, or at least to reduce their risk of harm. And that is one drink a night for women, and a drink is a 12-ounce beer or an ounce and a half of hard liquor or 5 ounces of wine, and two drinks a day for men, and no more than 7 in a week for a woman, no more than 14 in a week for men. No more than 3 in any one session for a woman and 4 in any one session for a man. Those are the limits beyond which we consider the use to be at-risk use.
All right, you answered one of our emailers' questions about having a glass of wine with spaghetti and dinner, and is that risking cancer? But I think you answered the question there. We're going to take another quick break when we come back. More of your questions and comments. The number is 800-399-3566, 1-800-399-3566. This is Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
Broadcast of Maine Calling is made possible by MPBN listener contributions and by Casella, committed to boosting recycling rates statewide through its One Bin, Zero Sort program. Casella, giving resources new life. And Halcyon Yarn in historic downtown Bath, with over 200 types of yarns and fibers for knitting, weaving, spinning, and felting. HalcyonYarn.com.
When teachers get training, it's not so hard to recognize gifted students.
They're quirky. They are a little bit argumentative, and they keep you on your toes, and they don't let you get away with anything.
But sometimes those things are harder to see in students still learning English. What some schools are doing to identify all gifted students, later on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Join us for All Things Considered coming up at 4 o'clock this afternoon. And ahead in just about 20 minutes on our 1 o'clock Public Affairs Hour, the Commonwealth Club of California hosts a panel discussion on corporate commitment to social justice and sustainable development. Again, that's ahead in just 20 minutes on the Commonwealth Club of California here on Maine Public Radio.
Welcome back. I'm Keith Shortall. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, helping healthcare providers identify those they treat who may have a problem with alcohol. With me in our studio, Mary Lindsay Smith. She's a research associate with the Cutler Institute of Health and Social Policy at the Muskie School of Public Service at USM. Joining us from our Bangor studio is Noah Nesson. He's Vice President of Medical Affairs at the Penobscot Community Health Center and has been a board-certified family physician in Maine for more than 30 years. And joining us from Washington, D.C., Sean Yardley. He's a founding member of the Bangor Area Recovery Network, past director of the City of Bangor's Health and Community Services. Join the conversation. Give us a call. The number, 800-399-3566. That's 1-800-399-3566. Let's go to Steve in Topsom. Hi, Steve.
Hi. I'm calling because I've had a fair amount of experience with alcoholism, with friends and family, and drug addiction as well, and have sort of taken my sister into Hazleton and Betty Ford Clinic and that, you know, sort of places that have worldwide reputations for dealing with addiction. And the surprising thing was that the counselors were that at a certain point say, there's really nothing we can do. If the person is going to stop using drugs or alcohol, they're going to do it on their own choice, and they're going to do it through a 12-step process and by being part of Alcoholics Anonymous. And there really isn't much that we can do beyond that. And I've heard a lot today about how to identify and how to screen and how to type and do all those sort of things. But what's the purpose of it if you don't have a treatment?
Yeah,
the only treatment is Alcoholics Anonymous, which I personally don't have any problem with that, we might as well agree that we're dealing with a disease that doesn't really have a cure that you can get out of a bottle.
Yeah. Sean, do you want to start?
Well, I think certainly when I have people that I come in contact with that I'm concerned about, I do suggest that they reach out to people that are in recovery, and whether that's through 12-step programs or just people that have successfully learned to live without alcohol being, you know, a part of their life. You know, you mentioned in the lead that I am a founding member of the Bangor Recovery Network, and that really is a great, you know, vehicle. And there's others around the state, not enough, where people can go and socialize safely without being influenced by or tempted by alcohol, because it's an alcohol-free environment with other people that are also looking for that same environment. So you make a good point. There aren't easy and available treatment programs. Abstinence, you know, for most is the recommended approach, but that isn't the only approach. So it's really trying to connect with others that, you know, have a shared desire not to drink or not to, you know, drink abusively.
Yeah, Dr. Nesson, Steve mentioned that this is a disease that can't be fixed from a bottle, but there are medications that you can prescribe if the person recognizes the problem and is willing to take some control of it.
That's correct. And although 12-step programs are one of the key resources we have, it's not the only way to approach on the behavioral side the problem of addiction to alcohol. And so, you know, faith-based programs help for some people. Cognitive behavioral therapy is a proven effective treatment for helping people with alcohol use disorder. And then we do have medications. And so as with any use disorder, if there's a medication that can help us with the compulsion to put that chemical into our body, that helps to free our brain up to do the work that we need to do to start recovery, to start the process of recovery and enter long-term recovery as our goal. And so there are a couple of medicines that are especially worth mentioning. Acamprosate, which helps to extend periods of abstinence for people with alcohol use disorder, and naltrexone, which reduces which in studies have shown to reduce the amount of alcohol that people drink when they do drink. And the two can be used together. So they're not a total answer, but they're a partial answer and can help people deal with the compulsion. I think more people are probably familiar with the drug antabuse or disulfiram, which causes sickness if you combine it with alcohol. And that's probably a less effective treatment, but another tool in the armamentarium. Having said those things, only about 10% of people being treated for alcohol use disorder receive prescriptions for any of these medications. And so it's a really underutilized resource. Again, not the total answer, but part of a bigger approach to helping people who want to recover from this disease.
Yeah, I was going to say, at what point in the consultation here, you have a patient that comes in and says, gee, doc, I think I'm drinking too much, but I really don't think I can quit doing it. Are you going to start with prescriptions? At what point would you consider a prescription?
The approach should always be a combination approach. And so certainly the behavioral work is the most important part of it. And that's what 12-step programs get at. Faith-based programs tend to get at those and cognitive behavioral therapy. But it can be augmented with these medications, and they can be offered at any point in it. Neither of these medicines has ill effects if somebody ends up drinking while they're taking them. And both can help, one by reducing the amount that they drink if they do drink, one by extending periods of abstinence. And there's value in that, both in the potential risks of harm to that person if they were to get intoxicated or to others, and in helping people begin to experience what it can feel like to have more extended periods of either alcohol-free time or intoxication-free time. And so there's value in both, and there's no reason not to offer it early on in somebody in whom you identify alcohol use disorder who's open to those approaches.
Before we run out of time, I want to make sure we get to Lindsay to talk about the pilot program of the Time to Ask initiative, which is really the hook of our show here. Tell us about it, if you would.
Sure. So myself, Noah, and Sean are part of the Time to Ask pilot project, which is funded by the Lunder Deneen Health Education Alliance of Maine. And our goal is to bring together a key group of stakeholders to design and implement an education and training program for a diverse group of healthcare providers in the state to help increase the rates of regular conversations and screening in primary care. We know that only about 1 in 6 people report ever having a conversation about alcohol use with their provider. That's around 16%.
Surprisingly low.
It is. Yeah. And that's despite the fact that we know that screening and brief intervention in a variety of settings is ranked as one of the most highly by the United States Preventive Services Task Force as one of their recommended treatment services. So what we've been doing as part of the pilot is a team of individuals from the Muskie School have gone out and collected data from 3 of our participating pilot sites, which is Bucksport Regional Health Center, Four Seasons Family Practice, and Pines Health Services. And we've collected data from both the organizations and the providers, because what we know about implementing quality improvement work in practices is that the change not only needs to happen at the provider level, but they also need that organizational support to be able to do this. So we're trying to develop something that is rooted in evidence and is also tailored to the specific needs of the providers and practices here in Maine. So we've just finished the first stage of our data collection, and really exciting to be able to compile all that data and see what the needs are here in the state. But really the goal is to break down some of those barriers that Noah discussed earlier and make providers feel more comfortable in their ability to initiate conversations, have standardized protocols for screening people, and be comfortable doing brief intervention, because we know that that is an effective treatment, especially for people on the lower end of the spectrum. But yet providers report not feeling that they have necessarily the clinical skills. So they report knowing the importance of addressing alcohol and the impact that it has on their patients' overall health, but they feel less comfortable engaging in some of the activities that Noah described earlier, such as using motivational interviewing to help patients make decisions about modifications in their drinking behavior.
Yeah. Noah and Sean, about a minute left here, but how would you envision what you'd like to see in terms of the healthcare landscape here in Maine with its, with respect to its, I guess it's the comfort zone and the skill level of screening folks for alcohol problems?
Well, I'd like to see a team-based approach that doesn't add too much to the burden of primary care providers in this state, that implements universal screening for alcohol use, identifies either alcohol use disorder or at-risk use of alcohol, and improves the self-efficacy, the confidence of our providers or members of their team. It doesn't have to be the primary care physician or PA or nurse practitioner, in helping to address that with patients so that we can move people to less risky use or to treatment of their alcohol use disorder if they have that. I think that would be satisfying for our healthcare delivery teams and good for the people of the state of Maine.
Well, it looks like you're moving in that direction. And with that, unfortunately, we're out of time, but thank you all for joining us today. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mary Lindsay Smith is a research associate at the Cutler Institute of Health and Social Policy at the Muskie School of Public Service, the University of Southern Maine. Noah Nesson, Vice President of Medical Affairs for the Penobscot Community Health Center. He's been a board-certified family physician in Maine for more than 30 years. And Sean Yardley, a founding member of the Bangor Area Recovery Network and past director of the City of Bangor's Health and Community Services. Jonathan Woodward ran the board today. We had additional technical help from Rich Tozier in our Bangor studio. You can find past editions of Maine Calling as well as a link to our audio archives by visiting mainecalling.net. And today's program will be rebroadcast this evening at midnight. The executive producer of Maine Calling is Jonathan Smith. Tomorrow on the program, Jennifer Rooks will have a conversation about the role of independence this campaign cycle. We'll hear from Colby College professor Sandy Mazel and with Wall Street Journal's Dante Chinney. We'll also discuss the prospects and possible outcomes of a contested GOP convention. I'm Keith Shortall. You've been listening to Maine Calling on the Maine Public Broadcasting Network.